Access number 28670, Mr. David Wilson, Reel 9. Now, tell me about this flight out with the advance party, because, flying was fairly unusual even then. I mean, what was the role of the advance party, and what were you going to do?
It was the first time I had flown, and the advance party consisted of the colonel and the admin officers, the adjutant and the battery commanders, and down probably to the warrant officers in the battery. There were 70 men in all, I remember, and it was a RAF Hermes we flew in, and it was from Blackbush Airport. I recall standing on the station. We got the train from, I think it was Marlborough, I don't think it was Swindon, it was the nearest one, Marlborough, standing on the station, and even at that stage we still didn't really know where we were going. Standing with all your kit, your full service marching order and your kit bag slung on the top, onto the train, and went to Blackbush, embarked onto the Hermes, and we're off within a couple of hours, and hopped at Malta for refuelling, just a couple of hours.
Hermes
aircraft, yeah.
What was the flight like? Was it? It's an RAF flight.
It was, again, the first time I had flown, and this business of being above the clouds, and, you know, the blue sky above and the clouds tinged with sunlight was quite magic. So, fortunately, I had a window seat and spent all my time looking out there. In retrospect, I realised it was a rough old flight because the noise inside was tremendous. But to me, I thought that was normal anyway at that stage. And we, as I say, hopped at Malta for refuelling. And then I can recall coming in over the Med and onto the, seeing the beaches and then the desert beyond, and thinking, what are we getting into here, you know? And of course, when we landed, it was RAF Fayed in the Suez Canal Zone. Which was a bit of a culture shock. I remember stepping out of the plane and it was like stepping into an oven. And then, once you got your kit together, there was no rest. There was an the RSM from the regiment we were relieving, which was, I think, was 3-9 Field Regiment. Sort of getting all the odd bods together and into QL Bedfords and away up. Up the line to the Fayed camp, and my main role personally was to assist in, and I found I didn't actually. I think I did most of it, taking over and signing for the vehicles that were relevant to us. At one stage, I was only 19-year-old, but at one stage I had about 6 or 7 vehicles on my signature, and the most dramatic and alarming one was a Sherman armoured recovery vehicle, which was quite something. And the I had signed for the Sherman with all its kit, and also the Scammel, which was, by this time, it was a Meadows engine Scammel that they had out there. It was a better kit. It was a petrol engine. It had an electric winch. It had a power winch. It was power takeoff, which the diesel Scammel didn't have. It was manual. And not the machinery truck, the radio truck, a GMC radio truck, 2 M20 BSAs, I remember the motorbikes, 6 or 7 vehicles in all, I remember, that I glibly signed my life away for.
Did you realise what you were doing when you signed?
Well, yeah, but you really don't have any choice. You're there to accept the vehicles on behalf of your regiment, and you're... during in the interim period between the regiment arriving and the advance party being there by themselves, you're totally responsible for the vehicle and its kit, which was quite a daunting prospect. And as I say, I found it stimulating, let's say. It was interesting. First time I had ever been elevated to such a status, you know, sort of signing for all this kit. It's a scallop. All of this.
Tell us about the Sherman Armoured Roof Recovery Vehicle. Well, that's new. We've not talked about that.
Well, no, this was the baby that I was. I became totally familiar with every nut and bolt on that.
Well, tell us as much as you can remember about it, because it's not a well-known. Well, Sherman is, but it's not.
Well, not the ARV, no. Well, when the main body of the regiment arrived, the vehicles obviously were transferred to the relevant personnel, and I got them off my signature, but I was left with one vehicle, and that was the Sherman Armoured Recovery Vehicle, which was in essence a Sherman chassis with the gun removed. The turret was cut away at the top, but it was welded solid, so it was part of the integral part of the hull. And inside the fighting compartment, they installed a winch and a drum. And the vehicle itself served as an armoured recovery vehicle and a crane, because what they also did was, at the front end of the vehicle, they pivoted a boom, which came up about 30 feet. It was about 30 feet high. And in its raised position, you had to climb up rungs up the side of the boom and put the winch rope and hook over the top of a pulley, and thereby it was usable as a mobile crane, armoured crane, as well as an armoured recovery vehicle. And the raising this thing was, I know now, I knew within a short space of time, why I was the mug that ended up with this thing, because nobody else really wanted it. None of the senior people wanted it. And what you had to do was you had the jib stowed back over, and it was retained by big pins in the back on the back of the hull. So you withdrew the pins. First of all, to go from the beginning, in the front suspension, you bolted a plate which lived on the front of the hull generally, but you bolted a plate to stop the front suspensions from dipping when you lifted any weight. And then there was a quadrant on the front of the right-hand boom extension, which had three holes in. And the holes were to raise, to lower, and to secure. And you put the winch rope, a separate rope, a wire rope, through the to raise position through the hole, put a pin in, and took it one loop around the front, a drum which was integral with the front driving sprocket. And then you jumped in and you drove this thing forward. And as you drove forward, the wire rope coiled onto the drum on the front sprocket, and up came this jib, which is, as I say, about 30 feet long, few tons in weight. And the pivot was right next door to your ear, and you could hear it grinding and squeaking. And as it came up, you then had to, when you got it into the vertical position, if you continue to drive forward, all you did was snap the ancillary rope on the quadrant. So you had to lock the vehicle with the jib in the upright position. And I used to crook my left arm around both the steering tillers, because on a Sherman, the steering tillers are also the brakes, or act as brakes, track brakes. Crook me arm around the steering tillers, and then feel for the big long gear lever that was way behind you, press the button on the top, select reverse, and as you selected reverse and started to move backwards, the jib came over the point of balance and fell forward against two thick wire hawsers, which were the restraining ropes in the forward position. And the whole thing used to rock. And you thought you were going to get pitched out. Anyway, that it was up then. And all you had to do then was secure it with at the quadrant. And then pay out the winch rope and get some mug off. There was nobody about. You had to do it yourself. Climb up the jib and put this thing over the... Put the hook over the... And then there you were.
And what would you use this crane for?
Well, it's the only time I ever used it in... for any useful purpose, was to demonstrate it to a group of senior officers who apparently were coming around the various units evaluating the armoured recovery vehicles that they had. And of course the Sherman was a fairly rare bird and they were very interested in seeing that. So I was, in fact it was on this occasion, I was detailed off to
To
go down to the tank park and demonstrate this crane. So took it down there, and the only thing that we could find, which quickly that was a useful subject, was a Cromwell, because on the back of the hull of a Cromwell you've got two massive lugs, which are built for the A bar for towing or for pushing or loading or whatever. And for recovery purposes, and all I had with the Sherman, as far as an appropriate device, let's say, was an air bar on the front of the hull, which would go into these two lugs, like a pair of scissor legs, onto the two lugs on the back of the Cromwell, and. So I put this on, and the shackles that I had were only 7 tonners. Put them on, and tongue in cheek, started to lift this thing when I was... of course, you had to put the power takeoff. You sat in neutral with the main engine running. Put the power takeoff into gear using the main clutch, your main driving compartment clutch. And then put the power takeoff into lift, into winch in. And start to lift, and this thing took the weight, and it fair enough, it lifted the back of this Cromwell maybe about 3 feet, 3 feet above the ground. And then to my horror, one of these guys gets underneath the Cromwell to have a look. What he was looking at, I've got no idea, but he's underneath. And I thought, oh God, you know, it goes, yeah, your life flashes in front of you. You think, if this comes down, I'll never get out of the army. I'll spend the rest of my time in Colchester, whatever, you know. And it was all right, and he got out, and they seemed to be quite satisfied, because we never did get any better equipment. They left us with the ERV. Then I lowered the thing down and put my gear back together and trundled away with it, and that was the only time I ever used it as a crane.
But you practice it?
Oh, yes, I raised the thing, and when went on firing camps with it.
Now, hang on, let's get... So, I've led you ahead a bit there, because I've got just an interest in that one. Now, so you signed and took over the vehicles, and then how long was it before the rest of the unit?
About 3 weeks before the main body of the three batteries and HQ.
Now, what happened when you all settled into camp? Fired camp.
Fired, well, when we settled in... and took over, the previous regiment left. They had identical equipment to the stuff that we had in Germany.
So Sextons.
Sextons, Cromwells. Each battery had a Cromwell, and for the forward observation officers. And there was three troops in each battery. Each battery had three. Each troop had three Sextons and a ram. That's for the troop commander. It was a section without a gun, they also had the fitters, the battery fitters, who were really sort of detached from the LAD. They had those white scout cars, the half tracks,
So the Cromwell tanks were
forward observation surveyors. They were for the surveyors. They were fast, they could be in position and calling the fall of fire and get out of it if it got too hot, you know. ideal for that.
So it's the Sexton, the Cromwell, and the white half track.
The white half track, and the among the soft skin stuff, they had those Land Rovers. There was no Jeeps. They were all Land Rovers out there, and a couple of M20Bs. There was a few sort of general service trucks. Again, the ubiquitous Bedford 1500 weight. But there was also some Chevrolets for general purposes, water Bowsers and that sort of thing.
Now, can we talk about the Sexton self-propelled gun? We're not really mentioning it. What did you think? I mean, it wasn't your job to do it, but I mean, what did you think of this, the Sexton?
Oh, yes, it was my job.
So, yeah, well, yes.
Yeah.
You were driving, I mean. Sorry, that's what I meant. Well, it's your job to maintain it. That's your job.
Yes, it was.
What did you think of the Sexton?
Well, the Sexton was a completely different kettle of fish from the British Cromwell and Comet. What you had was, for a kickoff, the engine was at the back, right at the back, in a very slim compartment. Slim, it was only necessary to be slim because the engine was actually a radial 9-cylinder air-cooled engine, which was actually an aero engine used, I think, in Dakotas and things like that. And it was a Wright Continental Whirlwind, they called them. And I remember they didn't produce as much power as the Meteor, but they produced, 450 brake horsepower at 2,250 RPM, governed. And that's lying on its back. One of the jobs that I ended up along with one other lad.
Stick to the vehicle.
Sorry. Right, the vehicle itself, it had the Wright's radial continental engine, air cooled engine in the engine compartment, right at the rear of the vehicle, accessed by only a couple of steel doors at the back, and of course the bolted on decking on the top of the hull. Very difficult to work on. You had to have a trained mouse to get in there. The only things you could see immediately you opened the doors was the carburetor and the two mags. The rest was way out of sight and totally inaccessible.
That must have been a real problem for you then.
It was a problem, but we overcame it. There was two of us that were involved as VM EFVs. We were, by this time, I should have said, also in Germany, I was detached on two occasions for a fortnight on each occasion to Duisburg to do upgrading courses, VMEFV courses.
We'll have to come back to that.
Right.
So carrying around the Sexton. So
well, by this time I was a VM class one and I had two stripes. And the jobs on the Sexton were first and foremost, we used to do the 406 inspections, which were it was like painting the fourth bridge. You start off with HQ battery and do HQ battery, D battery, G battery, M battery, and then start again on HQ battery. And the 4-6 inspections were tick box forms with A, B, and C jobs. A jobs were purely maintenance, driver's jobs, and troop jobs. Just the crew, the personnel that used the thing, that was their responsibility. Therefore, if you got too many A boxes ticked, the troop commander got into the hat from the colonel for not looking after his vehicles. B jobs were LED jobs, and C jobs were beyond local repair, BLR, workshop jobs. So you used to go around doing these, and of course, as I say, tick boxes, and it was, you started off engine, transmission, suspension, tracks, ancillaries, all the bits and pieces. And you just simply went through them. But also servicing of the SPs was our job.
Now, hang on, what were the things that would go wrong? What were the typical things that went wrong?
Well, typical things were that went wrong. Mainly, they were quite hardy. They were relatively simple. And quite hardy. The things that would go wrong would be track brake adjustment when it wasn't answering the tiller as well as it might. worn out tracks, because they had the rubber pad type tracks which were pinned, and they were bolted. You could take them off, they were easy. Really, there's nothing comes to mind as being a particular fault on the Sexton, which was basically a Sherman SP, wasn't it, you know. And they were quite hardy. There was one serious thing, but again it was neglect that caused it. If a radial engine stands for a given time, say 48 hours, without the engine being revolved, there's a chance that oil can drain down into the bottom cylinders, in which case, if by any chance they're on compression stroke with the valves closed and an attempt is made to start it, you can get a hydrostatic lock. In other words, the piston is trying to compress oil, which it can't, into a closed cylinder in the combustion chamber, and of course it will burst the engine wide open. And there was one or two occasions that happened, but it was down to the crew, because you had a big starting handle with a reduction of 10 to 1 on, and you used to have to, it looked ridiculous when you observed it. It was like these guys winding it up from the back like a clockwork tie. You had this long handle and you had to turn it 50 times in order to turn the engine over 10 times, so 5 times rather. And
then the oil would drain away.
Well, of course, if there was oil in the bottom cylinders, it was only two cylinders that could get into and maybe cause a hydraulic lock. But the valves used to open and the oil drained away. So then it was all right. And if you started after that, all you got was a cloud of blue smoke. But there was on a couple of occasions that it wasn't done, and the crew was in the hat in the course of the troop commander for not doing it. But generally speaking, they were reliable, robust, and the repairs that you mainly got.
What sort of repairs? What sort of servicing?
The servicing that you got involved in was, after a given number of hours, I forget how many now, but after a given number of hours, you had to do an engine service, and the engine service comprised of plug change, exhaust elbow, gasket change, carburetor clean, and mags, two mags, you've got an exhaust and an inlet mag, two mags, points gaps, points clean, do the points gaps, and also do the tappets, all of the tappets. But of course, in situ, this was almost impossible. So we devised, McPal and I, both, well, by that time, were both VM class 1, VM EFV class 1, two tapes each, and we found that using the scammel, using the jib on the scammel with a winch, we could have an SP engine out in less than half an hour, and we used to tip them on their back on wooden trestles, and of course then it was easy. You had it lying there, it was so accessible, it was great. You went around and did the exhaust elbows, which was taking each exhaust, the small manifold off each cylinder, and of course that's 9 cylinders. Put a new gasket on, tighten it all up, clean it all up. Do all the tappets, revolve the engine and do the tappet clearances. Change the plugs, and of course the plugs are quite an elaborate, there's an elaborate system of screening for the plugs. So you've got braided tubing over all of the plug leads and the plugs themselves. All that had to come off, all the knuckle joints that was on it. And because you've got two plugs per cylinder, because you've got an inlet plug and an exhaust plug. The exhaust plug fires 5 degrees before the inlet plug, because the mixture in the area of the exhaust valve is slightly hotter than that in the area of the inlet valve. That's the reason for having two plugs, to get the full flame spread across the combustion chamber. And as I say, that was exhaust elbows, tappets, clean the carburetor, do the mags, and do the tappets. And then we just used to upend it with a rope sling around it and drop it slotted back into the engine compartment. There was only four big bolts on the cradle that went right down into the hull. And I used to do, well, we used to take our turns. I would do the inside disconnections. And once we got the decking off, and Ed Potter would do the outside disconnections. And then we had this this pal that used to operate the winch on the Scammel.
Now, would other people use that method, or was that just
no,
you?
No, it was us. It was just us. And it was
so everybody else was fiddling about?
Fiddling about. And how they did it, I've got no idea.
So how long would it take to service an engine using your method?
It would take us about 4 hours to, that's in and out, and do the necessary while it was lying on the trestle.
4 hours?
4 hours. Yeah.
And how long would it take if you didn't take it out using the Scammel?
Well, quite honestly, I don't see how you could possibly do it without taking it out. So I would suggest that probably other people just sent them back to the workshops to get it done. I mean, I never heard of anybody, and certainly in Germany, I never came across it. They were always in use, and we didn't. I cannot remember servicing an SP engine in Germany, but in the Middle East it was, of course, I mean, with the tension in the Middle East at the time, although there was tension in Germany, the regiment had to be on standby more or less all the time, you know. I mean, it was at the height of the terrorist activity and all the rest.
I will come to that. Yeah. So that's anything else, any other parts of the servicing routine? That's the engine servicing. What else would you service?
Well, the gearbox was... 5-speed synchro mesh. It didn't require any servicing apart from oil changes. The track brakes, we used to adjust those. They did go out of the war, and they got out of sequence, and lost the vehicle lost its turning ability when that happened, because with the Sherman chassis that the 25 pounder was mounted on. You had normal controls. You had a brake, clutch, and throttle, but the steering was by, it was a control differential. In other words, if you braked one side, the other side speeded up, and the vehicle was steered by the tracks on that basis. So it meant that you had a double braking system, in as much as if you pulled the left-hand tiller, you would track left. If you pulled the right-hand tiller, you would track right. And if you pulled them both at the same time as you pressed the brake, you had a very effective braking system doubled up. But the difference between that and, say, the Cromwell was that it didn't matter about your speed. Your turning circle actually was dependent upon how hard you could pull on the tiller. And if it was out of adjustment, or you weren't pulling hard enough, you used to run out of road again with them, you know. Alternatively, if you were too enthusiastic, you could go too hard into a corner, and if the tracks were slack, for say on the desert, you could slew both the tracks off. And of course, that was another job, you know, getting it, splitting them and getting it back and driving them on the tracks, pulling me around the idler, and joining them up again and then readjusting them. So that was a job, but generally speaking, only after a breakdown on the desert.